The rest of you, if you would be so kind, if you are able and you can do it and want to, either in body or spirit, that is, stand with me as God's people stood at the foot of a mountain, so too we stand just to recognize that this is the primary place that God encounters us through his word, together as the body of Christ by his spirit, beginning in verse 13 of Matthew chapter 16. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his students, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others Elijah. Still others, Jeremiah, maybe one of the prophets. What about you?" He asks, who do you say, notice the flip on the question, "Who do you say I am?" Simon Peter answered, "You are the Messiah. You are the Son of the living God." Jesus replied, "Blessed are you, well done, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not, couldn't have been, revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father in heaven. And I tell you that you are Peter, or you are Rocky," that's his nickname. "And on this rock, I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." And then he ordered his students not to tell anybody that he was the Messiah. But from that point on, Jesus began to explain to his students that he needed to go to Jerusalem and to suffer many things at the hands of the elders and the chief priests and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed on the third day, be raised to life. And Peter takes him aside and begins to rebuke him. "No. No, never, not you, Lord," he said. "That shall never happen to you." And Jesus turned to Peter and he says, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the concerns of God. You do not have in mind the concerns of my kingdom. You merely have human concerns, your concerns." And then Jesus says to his students, "Whoever wants to be my student, my disciple, must deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it. What good will it be for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their life, their soul? For the Son of Man is going to come. He will, in his Father's glory with the angels, and then he will reward each person according to what they have done. But truly I tell you, some who are standing right here will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." These are the stunning words of God. You may be seated. The way to Jerusalem is paved with great expectations. It is the city of the great king. It is the city of joy, the city of the joy of the whole earth. It's the place where the living God said, "Yeah, I'm putting my name on that. That's going to be where I live. That's where I'm going to dwell," right? As it says in Psalm 132, "For the Lord has chosen Jerusalem, Zion, for his dwelling place, for his home." And for how long, by the way? How long is he going to consider Jerusalem his home? Yeah, for all generations. It's the city that David built his house in. It's the city that David planned to build the house of God. And there's debate even within the Old Testament whether God ever wanted that house to be built, but it's still the place where he wanted to build the house that God was going to live in. It's the place that Jerusalem is, the place that in exile, if you recall, Daniel keeps his window open facing that city as he prays, and at great risk to his own life. Abraham visits that city on his first journey. Legend has it, Jerusalem on that rock is where Abraham goes to sacrifice ultimately his son. Legend also has it that that's where Adam and Eve is buried. There's no evidence for that, and nobody's ever found it, and I didn't even know how they would figure that out anyways if they were to find Adam and Eve buried there. But that's how, and what legend says, is that's where Adam and Eve is buried in Jerusalem. It's the city of dreams. It's the Jerusalem, a breathtaking place, sitting atop the Judean mountainside. You can see how there's a lot of coniferous trees there, in fact, but here's a kind of image of after a rainy season where everything's green. It's hard to make it out, but in the left-hand corner as you reach the sky, you can actually see Jerusalem from there as you make your way to the city, which is beautiful. The way getting there is gorgeous, as well as gorgeous architecture, gorgeous buildings, gorgeous views, gorgeous plant life, gorgeous weather. As you make your way into the city, you have those twisting alleyways that were obviously created before automobiles, and as you make your way through some of those automobile light, or those alleyways, you see these shafts of light sort of penetrating, as well as, you know, the courtyards there in the city. When you're in there, you get all the smells that the city has to offer, the smells of spices, the smell of olive oil, the smell of sweet wine, the smell of fresh-baked Jerusalem bread, and then you hear all of the languages of all the various different kinds of people that travel there, praying in their own language. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. But as you know, it is also a place of pain. It's the place that, you know, when David took it over, he kicks out the Jebusites. In fact, in about, I think it was around, give or take, don't hold me to it, like 1996, Israel, full propaganda style, was going to celebrate the 3,000-year anniversary of the day that David had done this, which came with great criticism by the Israelis because they wanted to push the date even further back. It came with great criticism by the Palestinians as well, because if you, and they would have said, have you ever read, you know, 2 Samuel, where the king David and his men went into Jerusalem, notice, against the Jebusites and the inhabitants of that land, and they violently killed them, violently took over. It wasn't a sort of, in other words, there were inhabitants there before David ever got there. But since then, Jerusalem has been one of those places that have, you know, been besieged, destroyed, rebuilt, besieged, destroyed, rebuilt, besieged again, destroyed ever since David went into that city against the Jebusites. It's been fought over ever since that moment. And you might have heard, unless you live under a rock, that there is still tension in that region. How many of you have heard of this tension? Okay, just making sure. You know, you have the Israeli side, you know, basically, you know, wanting to, because they're a sovereign nation, defend themselves. You have, you know, Palestinians calling for a stop to, you know, open-air prisons, to this sense that they've been second-class citizens, the expansion of settlement areas where, in some cases, some Palestinians have been kicked out, which, you know, have been there for over 2,000-plus years. You have, on some, you know, the Palestinian side, the extreme side, you know, the enacting the atrocities of October 7th, after years and years, decades, centuries of just bitterness. And then you have the chants by the Palestinian side from the river to the sea, which is a not so subtle way of basically indicating that if you're a Jew and you're in that area, you have to go or be eradicated. Like any Jew living there is considered occupation. And so it seems that both sides have, and they haven't forgotten this, but both sides seem to, in their actions, have forgotten that they're both children of Abraham. And they both have, in one sense, right to that land. So when you're on, like, the main street in East Jerusalem, in the Palestinian district, you feel it, man. You feel the tension. You feel the bitterness. You feel the nervousness that they could also be kicked out, as, you know, a settlement might expand into that region, and that has happened in Jerusalem. When you get into, you know, the 7 miles in the opposite direction, in the ultra sort of Orthodox district, you feel it there too. You feel the memories of the Holocaust. You really do. And the memories of Hitler. And you feel even the longing still amongst the ultra Orthodox, especially the longings for a Jewish king, for the Messiah. And so, you know, it's always been this like city that represents the joy of the entire earth, and yet it represents the pain of the world, side by side, in the same place, in the same location. But in the Jewish story, and that would be the Hebrew Bible, our Old Testament, there were really two reasons why you would go there. There are two reasons you'd go to Jerusalem. The first is to enthrone a king, or to pay homage to one who's already on a throne. The second reason you would go there is to meet God, to worship God, to worship him for his provisions, to worship him for his forgiveness, yes, and to worship him for his salvation, to offer sacrifices to this God for his promises. It wasn't ever that easy, of course, right? There were times that Jews went up to Jerusalem and they didn't really like the king that was on the throne. And not only that, the presence of God would often be obscured by the chief priests, even blocked. And so God would send prophets, and those prophets would make clear how we were to worship God. But even some of those prophets would obscure what worship of God meant in this way. And then it's not just that. For long periods of time, even in the Old Testament up till today, rumor has it that God, like Elvis, has left the building. He's no longer in Jerusalem. He left a long, long time ago, years ago. And it's not just that. Galileans at the time of Jesus, when they would go into the city, they would go with both and. They would go with great expectations, hope, and joy, and yet frustrations. They would go there three times a year in excitement, worshiping on the high holy days. They even understood that Jerusalem was the place that God was going to return to, so they had tremendous hope. But every time they went, it was sort of like a slap in the face, man, because these lunatics ran the temple. These chief priests who used their positions to basically, they were puppets of Rome, but they basically used their positions to, you know, bolster their political aspirations or to continue their, you know, aristocracy in this way. So when a Galilean Jew would go to Jerusalem, it was always both and, right? They would sing the Psalm of Ascent, "We're going to the house of God today." But they would also have this deep longing, this yearning for when can we go with the king? When are we ever going to go with the Messiah and, you know, finally kick the you-know-what out of the chief priests? Finally kick out the Romans. Finally bring justice so that we can actually have peace and worship the God that we ultimately desire to. So when Jesus takes them to this place, Caesarea Philippi, which is not only a place of pagan worship and things like that, you can actually see the temple in this image, but it's a place 20 miles north of Galilee. It's right on the foothills of Mount Hermon, and you can imagine them seeing Jerusalem, not literally seeing it, but in their mind's eye. It's clear to me they have Jerusalem in this scene on their mind. The 12, at least, certainly believe this might be the exact moment that they were always waiting for, to finally go there. Jesus had just led them through the Galilee region, doing astonishing things, healing in an astonishing way, speaking about his kingdom, inviting people to join him in his kingdom and help him in his kingdom. Not that that brought clarity to everybody. There were people still confused, which is, you hear it when Jesus asks the question in this scene, who do people, and notice, who do people say the Son of Man is? And the response is, well, some think Elijah, some think Jeremiah, some think John the Baptist, some think, you know, some other sort of prophet. And then he flips the question. And when he flips the question, it's revealing in and of itself. He says, yeah, but who do you think I am? And you can imagine the awkward pause. And this is where, if any of you have ever led a classroom or a book study, or you just had to lead a group of people, you're thankful for people like Peter, right? Peter is the one who, after an awkward moment, like, just breaks everything and answers for everybody else. And if you're a teacher, you're like, I love Peter's. So if you're actually that person in a group setting, know that you probably have a lot in connection to the disciple that is Peter. But once, after that awkward pause, he says, well, shucks, you're the Messiah. You're the Son of the living God. And by that, he doesn't mean you're the second person of the Trinity. co-equal to the Father, through whom everything has been made, without whom nothing has been made. He's not trying to make a Trinitarian claim there. He's not trying to make a theological claim there in that way. That would come later, post, you know, Jesus' resurrection, post the Spirit revealing more to them. In this scene, all he means is, you're the man. You're the man we've all been waiting for. You're the king. You're the king that we've been waiting to go to Jerusalem with for some time. And to me, given the Jewish expectations, I think Jesus is actually taken aback by his response, in which is why he's ready to reveal a little more. He's like, this couldn't have been just, you couldn't have come up with that on your own. You couldn't have. That has to have been given to you by my Father, at which point then he reveals a little more. And he says, and again, there's some cultural things going on here that I'm not going to get into necessarily, but he says, on this rock, I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. Now, there are many ways you can go. The Catholic Church goes in one direction and putting this all on Peter. There's other places you can go with this, given the context of Caesarea Philippi. I tend to agree with scholars who believe Jesus here is sending a coded message. He's still 100 miles off. He's still 100 miles north of the city of Jerusalem, but I'm in agreement that this is actually a coded, subversive shot across the bow of Jerusalem, the city. It's the only city that was on a rock. That's what it was known as, the city on a rock. It was a temple built on a rock. And he had just gotten done teaching, like, if you build your house on the sandy land, it's foolish. You should build your house ultimately on the rock of his words. I think he is sending a signal, hidden though it is, a signal to none other than the city of Jerusalem. So when Peter finally recognizes who he is, and he does in this scene, you can imagine what he's thinking. He's thinking what every other Jew would have thought. He's thinking, man, when we roll into that town, when we roll into Jerusalem, they are going to not know what hit them. They're not going to know. They're not going to know what hit them. For now, though, they have to keep this all quiet. He doesn't want them to tell anybody. But notice, and this is why I think it's a shot across Jerusalem, from that moment on, his days in Galilee are over. The focus on Galilee is over. He even says as much. It's time to head south. It's time to go to Jerusalem. Why would he need to go there at all? We just take it for granted that he has to go there, but why would he need to go? That's where kings go, to be enthroned. And that's precisely what they wanted. That's precisely what they were waiting for. That's precisely what they were expecting. And here's the thing. His disciples are ready. What they're not ready for is the throne. What they're not ready for is the nature of what Jesus has in mind. He says as much, when the Son of Man goes to Jerusalem, he's going there to be handed over. And they're like, what? Wait, what? Yeah, he's going there to be handed over to suffer at the hands of those who are corrupted. That doesn't make, you can imagine when he just lays this out. The Son of Man is going there to be handed over to suffer at the hands of the chief priests and the teachers of the law, and he's going to die. At that moment, they flatline, right? Their minds don't, they don't even hear him say, and 3 days later, rise, which wouldn't have made any sense to them, say anyway. So when Jesus says that line, all of their hopes, all of their expectations are dashed against that rock. Essentially, all of their hopes just got literally crucified. You see, they wanted a king, there's no doubt about that, but they wanted it the way that they wanted it. They wanted a king, they just wanted it in their image. And I think they knew it was going to be tough. I really do. I think they knew there was going to have to be a fight. I think they knew there was going to be a lot of hard work to get this thing done. In fact, I can imagine Peter twisting the message of Jesus. You're going to, Peter, have to pick up your cross. And I can imagine him going, yeah, that's what this is going to be. We're not afraid of doing the hard thing. Those who do hard things in life win. Right, Jesus? Those who face the things that nobody else wants to do, they're victorious. Right? Hey, Jesus, right? That's what you're talking about. That's what you're talking about? Sure, it's going to be hard. They didn't perhaps fully understand the deeper meaning of what he was talking about. That if anybody wants to follow me, they're going to have to deny themselves, deny their expectations, deny their wants, deny their life, and take up their cross. In fact, if you want to save your life, you're going to have to lose it. And anyone who loses their life for my sake will find it, because what does it gain anyone to gain the whole world, gain Jerusalem, win in Jerusalem, and forfeit your life, forfeit your soul? See, part of the paradox of all of these stories is that those who are closest in proximity to Jesus misunderstand him the most. It's also what lends credibility to many of these passages in the New Testament. Why would you portray Christianity in this fashion? Those who are closest to him don't understand him. They were right. Peter here is right. Jesus, yes, is going to be king. Yes, king of the Jews. Yes, even king of the entire world. Just not the king that they wanted. Just not the king that they expected. I think we do this. I really do. I think we do this every time we allow our lives, our dreams, our wants to dominate the ways in which we see the Christian faith that ignores the call to suffer, a Christian faith that ignores the call to deny ourselves, the Christian faith that ignores the call to lose our lives for his sake, that ignores the cross. Because if we're honest, I think we also really want Jesus to be on the throne. I do. I think we all want him to be king. We just want him to be king in such a way that he underwrites our lives, underwrites our dreams, underwrites our expectations, even, say, underwrites our aspirations and our ambitions. But here's the thing. The way to Jerusalem has always been the way of flipping all of those expectations upside down. And frankly, even our aspirations. Or if you look at it right side up, depending on how you're looking at it. As anyone here knows, the way to Jerusalem and the reason you would go there, the primary reason to go there, is ultimately to meet God. Now you know, post-Jesus resurrection, post the Spirit of God being poured out, post Paul's letters, you don't have to go to the geographical space that is Jerusalem to do that. Jesus says as much, right? In John 4, he puts it this way, "Believe me, the time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain," and he's on, you know, in Samaria, "nor in Jerusalem." So you don't have to be in Samaria or Jerusalem to worship God. A time is coming. In fact, in Jesus, it has now come when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. God's never been bound to or confined to a geographical space. However, that's a radically new idea. That's radically different, by the way, than like Psalms. When you read the Psalms, we sang one of them this morning, Psalm 42, "As the deer pants for the water, so my soul longs after thee." What's the next line in that? Or give or take, right after that. When can I go meet God? I don't think we should over-spiritualize that. This was written when Israel was in exile, and they longed to be back into the geographical, spatial place that God had promised to be present for generations. And by the way, Jerusalem today as a geographical place is still seen as that place by many, including even sometimes Protestant Christians. It's often said that Jerusalem is the hub of the great three Abrahamic traditions, right? You have Judaism, you know, Christianity, and Islam. I've always told people you need to add one more ism to that. That is called tourism. It's their number one income, by the way, as well, in Jerusalem. But tourism is sort of the modern secular version of going on a journey. Tourism is sort of the modern secular version of going on a pilgrimage, road trip, you know. We go to famous places. We go to beautiful places. We go to these places, though, not to meet God. We don't go there even to receive a blessing or to be healed. And certainly we don't go there necessarily to be changed. We go there to see the things that people said we should go there to see. You know, go visit the places that, hey, you really need to put this on your bucket list. You know, or you really need to go and see what the world has to offer, increase your experiences, travel a little more, expand your horizons so you can expand your perspective in order maybe to bring some of those things back into your private life, share them, maybe images, social media, or maybe just a more exotic story at your, you know, personal wine and book club. Meaning we journey, we pilgrimage, we go to these places, even to sense the magic that these places have to offer, including food and culture and things like this. But here's the thing, when we go to these places, we always still remain at a critical distance. We remain critical observers, not getting too involved, certainly not journeying outside of the resort, that's too dangerous. Maybe we say a prayer when the plane takes off, if we're into that kind of thing, shoot a photo, but then we move on. We move on to the next place. My point is, we go to these places, but we go to these places expecting not to have our realities disturbed. We even go to these places certainly not to have our lives disturbed. In fact, if our lives got disturbed on any of these trips, we'd call our travel agent quickly and say, hey, we need a refund or some kind of, you know, compensation. And that's sort of my point. The way to Jerusalem, or to bring the metaphor full on, the way to this Jesus stands for the way into the presence of the living God. The living God who disturbs. The living God who continues to hide himself from the learned. And he continues to hide himself from the sophisticated. And he continues to reveal himself to those who've been crushed by the world. He continues to reveal himself to those who are sick and are dying, who have no hope. Babies. Even Jerusalem is still a place today that you can go and easily be religious. I used to have friends that studied at Hebrew University, and when people would find that out, they'd be like, oh, what is that like? Must be one of those super Christians, right? It's easy to go to that city as a geographical place and be religious, where God gets remade in our image, serves our ends, baptizes our dreams, underwrites our lives, but we continue to hide. We continue to hide from the presence of the living God, which still comes with difficult questions, the difficult questions of Genesis 3. Where are you? Who are you? What are you doing? See, whether or not you ever, I ever make it to the geographical city of Jerusalem, that's not my point. I'm not with those who believe you have to go there to be a real Christian or something like that. And this is what I mean. It's just as easy to be a tourist of Christianity. I've met them. I've met tourists of Christianity within the church. I've met them outside of the church. I've been one myself. And what does a tourist of Christianity look like? A tourist of Christianity enjoys all the benefits that Christianity has to offer. And let me just let you know, there are plenty of them. The covering over of all your shame. The complete eradication of all of your guilt, all of your unholiness, put on an entirely other human being because he wanted to and longed to. More courage than you would ever dare ask. More convictions than you ever wished for. More energy than any workout would ever provide. More peace than you could ever rationally get your mind around. Benefits. But then we shake those all off before someone comes up to us and asks us to volunteer or needs our presence or needs our time or needs our ear or, God forbid, needs our resources. Meaning we shake all those benefits off before the demands start coming. We shake all of those things off before the cross ever starts creeping into the conversation. You see, the test of whether or not we're on the way to the city, or what we might say, on the way to and with this Jesus, is, are we prepared? Are we prepared to have this God remake us? Are we prepared to have this God lovingly break us? And then are we prepared to have this God remake us in his image? Are we prepared to have this God disturb our time and disturb our lives, you know, those things that we carefully construct and protect at all costs, in order to remake us in his image based on his promises, which I promise you will be different than what you want. In fact, that's a sign. I always tell people, you know, a sign that you're on the way to the city or to this Jesus. If everything's going the way you wanted it to go, better than you could have ever dreamed of, that might be a sign you're not on the way. On this side of Jesus' return. It's always been that way. The Christian faith's always been that way. It's the most inviting thing on the planet, and yet it's the most disturbing thing. It's the most promising thing you'll ever encounter. It's the most threatening thing. It's the thing that asks everything of you, and yet it gives everything in return. But those on the way, and I believe this, those on the way by the Spirit of God are better enabled than ever to hear God in his word, hear God through these waters, hear God through this table, hear his voice, the God who truly does love us more than we even love ourselves. And it's why he's the only one. And I mean that. Nobody else can ask. A pastor can't ask this of you. Nobody can ask. You can't even ask this of you. He's the only one who can ask us for what we don't actually want to give. And it's our lives. Would you please pray with me? Our Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, God, we bless your name. In these days of Lent, we turn to walk towards the city with you, where we, God, we meet your Son, our true guide and light, the full presence of the living God, and God, we live in eager expectation until Easter Day. We bear the silence, the call to follow, the call to deny ourselves, the call to lose our lives for your sake. The cross, even the pain of those around us, difficulties and suffering, well, brothers and sisters that you have provided help sustain our courage and faith until your big feast. And God, though this road to the city to follow you is hard, and it's incredibly steep, we give you thanks for your Spirit, whoever calls us through the grace of your cross. Through the path of dying, through the path that is dark and deep until we see the coming of your dawn. And we pray this in Jesus' name, and all of God's people say,